Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 106th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is high wages, the engine of economic growth and well-being. I'm joined by Morris Altman, the author of Worker Satisfaction and Economic Performance, which is in its third edition. The publisher is Routledge. Morris has published over 130 refereed papers, 17 previous books, and he has had academic positions at a variety of institutions and countries, for that matter, from the University of Saskatchewan to posts in New Zealand, Australia. He's been at Stanford, Cornell, Duke, and Hebrew University. He is now the dean of the University of Dundee's School of Business. Welcome to the show, Morris.
Thanks a lot, Dan. Pleasure to be here.
Great. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So give us a brief overview of the book, if you don't mind.
Well, a very brief overview of the book is that I found that there are serious gaps in economic theory, which plays a huge role in informing policy, even when there's no evidence to back up what a lot of economists tend to say. So what I try to do is to correct for that gap and that error in economic theory. So this book, in a nutshell, is all about demonstrating, based on the evidence, using robust economic theory, that increasing wages, improving the well-being of workers, will not cause harm to the economy and to the firms. In other words, firms can remain competitive and profitable while increasing wages and benefits to workers. It's a dynamic type of model. It's a dynamic type of process. But basically, this flies in the face of what you hear said by many economists, that if you increase wages, you increase minimum wages, you have unions, so increasing the bargaining power of workers, what's going to happen? Well, wages go up, costs go up, profits go down. There'll be a huge disaster. So the best thing to do is to let firms do their own thing, including cutting wages, shifting production to China and God knows where else. And eventually workers will benefit. Historically, that's not how things work and how things have not worked. And basically, the book follows some of the wisdom of the great Adam Smith, that when wages go up, workers' benefits increase, productivity goes up, efficiency increases, and everyone can benefit from this.
Well, I have a lot of interest in Adam Smith, so we're gonna definitely go there. One of the things I'm curious about, so the book was originally published, I guess, the first edition in the late 90s, then 2001, and then a 20-year gap. So you talked about the gap in terms of how economics and wages and so forth is looked at by economists, but there's also a gap in the publishing history. I think the book's hugely relevant to today's arguments, but I'm curious, why now did you bring the book back?
Well, because a lot of the same arguments, the same debates, the same challenges remain, because if you, not only in the West, but in the developing world, I think advisors are dominated by the same type of ideas that they get from Harvard, MIT, Oxford, Cambridge, and all over the place around the world, that if you want to move forward, the way to move forward is to keep labor markets very flexible and to do one's best to keep wages, for real wages, from growing, keep benefits from moving forward, because that's the main instrument for pursuing economic growth. It's the way to increase savings, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the same type of challenge. And what I hope is that when people are exposed to this different type of mental model, which is more reality-based, then this will allow for a shift in the way policymakers think and politicians think. So we can actually move forward in a more dynamic type of a sustainable and dynamic type of capitalism. Because right now, capitalism, which I think is the best instrument to move forward, is in trouble because a lot of people are really upset. Working people upset, middle class people, small businesses. These people are really upset, and they buy into the myth that the best way to resolve the problems of the world is basically to kick out the immigrants, to stop immigration, and everybody will be happy. Or Putin's solution is just conquer some other countries and take their wealth and kill a whole bunch of people, and whoopee-doo, everything will work. There is a better way, and capitalism can work if it's thought through more carefully and one introduces light forms of regulation into the market.
Okay, well, I've loved what you just said, because I think that's why the book is indeed so relevant today. I mean, first of all, in the U.S., the minimum wage hasn't budged in, you know, what, 15 years or something?
That's right.
It's at a level that can't possibly allow those workers to buy housing, for instance, in major cities. And then we have the Great Resignation, as all sorts of people basically bailed out of their current job, saying, I'm not being really treated like I'm essential. You're right, the Ukrainian conflict, war, not a special operation,
right,
brings these questions of freedom and respect for human decency right back into the fold. So I just think your timing for the book is inadvertently or not tremendous, because I think these issues are very much with us, and the question of what kind of capitalism we want is front and center. So let's go back to the founder, or sometimes he's referred to as the founder or the father of capitalism. That would be Adam Smith. Obviously, there's two books there, The Theory of Moral Sentiments and The Wealth of Nations, the latter being the more famous of the two. But to me, the first one is awfully important in terms of who Adam Smith is and what his value system was. Can you talk about the legacy of Smith, maybe how it's misunderstood or the Moral Sentiments book is perhaps overlooked at times?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think Adam Smith is he's a man full of contradictions, and as are his books, if you go through them. But I think Adam Smith's worldview, I think, is that capitalism will not be a viable entity unless it's characterized by what he refers to as moral sentiments. So basically, people need empathy and sympathy for others. If they have that, then the economy and society will be prosperous for all. And at the same time, he argues that he contradicts himself, but basically, if you don't have moral sentiment and sympathy, and labor markets are tight, that's why he loved what I guess some people would call globalization, more and more trade. If there's more and more demand for workers because of products imported from the UK, Scotland, England, Wales at that time, then labor markets get tight, and it increases the bargaining power of workers, and their wages will go up. And that's compensated by more efficiency from workers. So there's two sides to Adam Smith. He believed in the market. And at some points in his book, he said, well, free markets, everything will be fine. But at other points, he argues that if capitalists and also others don't have that notion of sympathy and moral sentiment, then things will not work well for society as a whole.
Yeah, no, I thought all contradictions aside, there was a moral, empathetic component to Smith that I think gets overlooked at times. It's not just back off and let happen what's going to happen, and it could be a bloodbath for workers who just get exploited. And I thought Smith was coming from a fairly different place, actually. I'm curious for your vantage point on, you know, there's been a lot of hullabaloo about moving from shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism. What's your view? To what extent do you think that that movement, that rhetoric from the business roundtable is genuine and will prove its mettle over time?
Well, it depends what one means by shareholder versus stakeholder. I've done a lot of work on employee-owned firms. So this is type of a stakeholder capitalism or co-ops, multi-stakeholder cooperatives that are owned by workers, by consumers, and by the larger community. We know from the evidence that those type of co-ops work, and they can be very efficient, and they can be very productive, and they can be sustainable when people are treated decently, or at least half decently. So stakeholder capitalism, if that means that actually everybody's empowered, including workers, they truly have a say in how the firm works, well, that can improve the well-being of workers. It's not going to damage the well-being of capitalists. So it's workable. But the question is the rhetoric really matched the reality of what a lot of CEOs want to do? My sense, from what we can see from the United States, Canada, Britain, is that a lot of capitalists, that's probably a horrible term, a lot of these individuals who own businesses, a lot of this is talk. A lot of it is rhetoric. And I'm not seeing that rhetoric being implemented. Therefore, I think the institutions that we have need reform. We just can't leave things to the free market. I think you need more information to workers and to capitalists as to the viability of a higher wage economy. But you also need institutions that strengthen the ability of workers to improve their position, to improve their bargaining power. And also the bargaining power of smaller firms, small, medium-sized enterprises. So that also goes to the notion of cooperatives, because there's also these small companies that need to survive. And they have weak bargaining power, and they get very often crushed by the bigger companies that end up making more profits. And it disincentivizes the smaller firms, which are the largest driver of employment in most Western capitalist economies.
Yeah, no, I've been seeing the statistics on how little the antitrust laws have, been enacted or put to use in, it's been really a precipitous decline over the last 20 years. And it's hard not to chart that vis-a-vis how much the politicians need, at least in America, to get reelected and who they're going to turn to. I was also interested in your comment on cooperatives, because I'm from North Dakota by family background. It's the only place in the U.S. that has a state bank and a state grain mill still, both legacies of the Nonpartisan League of North Dakota, which was an attempt to correct some inequities going on in that market for farmers. So one of the things I think was interesting from what you just said is earlier you mentioned immigration. So both in Great Britain with dropping out of the standing arrangement with the continent in Europe and with Trump here in the U.S. I just saw that one of the drivers for everyone scrambling to find workers is that immigration in the U.S. Starting about 2016 has dropped by approximately 4/5. Right. Some people are talking now that with Russia kind of getting in some measure kicked out of the world economy, that we might have deglobalization. What kind of vantage point do you have on that, if you don't mind?
Well, first, the anti-immigration, the popularity of the anti-immigration rhetoric and public policy, I think part of that is because, let's say in the United States, I'm not American, I'm Canadian, now living in the UK, but I think what's happened in a lot of modern capitalist economies is the needs and the well-being of working people have been pretty much ignored by Democrats as well as Republicans. So
agreed.
So you have people who are, their lives are destroyed, and there's immigration. So it's easy to blame the immigrant, but very few people are saying in the coal towns, in the steel towns, and the places where automobiles were produced, and all these domains throughout the United States and even in Canada, well, no, nobody, people are talking about a whole bunch of important topics, environment, about gender, this, that, and the other, and about race, all of which are important, but people are forgetting about the basic needs of working people throughout the US, Canada, and Great Britain. And that is really, I could use a bunch of swear words, but that's really upsetting. These are not crazy people, these working people. They're really upset. And so they're looking for a solution. And if they don't have, they're loaded with false information, and such as what Putin's providing to the Russians or Trump provided to the American people, say, okay, let's try this way, because the Democrats haven't helped us, Republicans before. Well, let's try Trump. In the UK, they went to Boris Johnson, blaming everything on Europe. And now the economy is even worse than before. But a lot of workers, a lot of former Labour Party supporters went to the Conservatives, because Labour is only talking about politically correct stuff, and actually the needs of the working people were ignored. So it was an easy scapegoat. I don't think we're going to have deglobalization. I think Russia was only in some ways part of that global economy. It produced oil and gas and a lot of grains. So the question then is, in certain areas, we need to pay closer attention to with regards to who we trade with and who we rely on. You can't rely on tyrants. You can't rely on unstable regimes. If we want to play ball, we have to play ball with people. We need to bring people onto our team that we can trust and we rely on. So it's maybe a readjustment to globalization, to that division of labor, Adam Smith's comparative advantage.
Okay. Yeah, no, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, the Russian economy is only about the size of Spain's economy or maybe Italy's. So it's really important in certain sectors, as you mentioned, grain and energy supplies, but otherwise it's been fairly nominal to date. So one of the things I think I find fascinating as I've watched the headlines unfold is everyone's glee over seizing the yachts, et cetera, of the Russian oligarchs. But actually, we have a lot of oligarchs in the West. Bezos just created a new yacht that's so big they're going to have to dismantle a bridge, I believe, in the Netherlands to get it out of port. So it seems to me that there is a lot of issues about people who are getting their basic needs ignored, and a lot of people who are being given a very free hand. I guess what I'm bringing myself around to is a question: to what extent can we, because the Ukrainians are arguing that they are trying to help save the mantle of the West, and I think they really are trying to, speak to democracy and to freedom of choice and something as opposed to tyrants. Do we have democracy at all in the workplace? Do we have companies that have been successful in having a more democratic workplace that you've found in your studies?
Well, democracy is a tricky business. I don't think it's an absolute term. We don't have perfect democracies. But what we have in the United States is better than what we have in Russia, or what we have in Canada is better than what you have in China. But in the workplace, we can even take university campuses. That's a workplace. They're not completely democratic. You look at factories. Factories are run by bosses. Workers can have very, very little input in the process of production. But you have some firms that have moved towards a more cooperative way of running the firm, still privately owned. So you do have worker-owned companies. They're not many, because it's very high risk. So that's one thing. But you do have, I guess one example, and it's not a perfect example, is with regards, if you compare Costco to Walmart, Costco has had in the past a much more collaborative perspective and cooperative perspective with regards to its workers, in terms of pay, cooperation, trust, as compared to Walmart. So, and Costco does very well; it's very profitable, and of course, Walmart is also doing well; it's profitable. So you have, in a way, this a high wage versus a low wage way of running a business. Now, both can be profitable, but you have examples of the more cooperative approach to running businesses, and they do work. But a lot of firms either don't believe they can work, and that flows from the mental models they're exposed to from economists, mainly from economists. So changing that mental model is important. On the other hand, some of my research and more recent research shows us some people who run companies would rather not take the high wage road, even if it's completely profitable and economically viable, because this reduces their relative social and economic positioning in their firm, in their society. So relative standing can be really important. Oh, you know, the higher I am, the better I feel. It's nothing to do with, my firm can be viable if I increase the wage rate by 15%. So that relative positioning is important. Therefore, things are not going to happen automatically, because if people like where they are, so as economists say, they're maximizing their utility, they're not going to change. So you do need that pressure. And I don't think it's not the state forcing things necessarily. It's empowering people so that they can get what they want, and then things can be organized at the firm level.
Yeah, well, I raised the question because one thing I constantly see in the business literature is everyone bemoaning the low employee engagement rates when they do the surveys. I don't remember the number offhand, but it's, you know, in the range of 20% or some such abysmal number. And every time I read it, I think, well, of course, because by and large, I'm pretty sure they feel unempowered. And at the same time, they can look at what kind of money the CEO is pulling down. And, you know, we're both fans of behavioral economics, and we know, you know, there's the inequality bias, if you feel like the game is unfair, you take punitive steps, even if it doesn't help you, just because, you know, it pisses you off that this is the situation.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. So fairness is really important. Say in behavioral economics that fairness matters. That if you're unfair, people will retaliate to beat up on those people who are treating them or perceived to be treating them unfairly. But what's really interesting, and I think this is one of the things I try to show in my book and other publications, is that firms that are unfair can also survive. It's not that if you're unfair, you're going to go bankrupt, which is what some behavioral economists would like to say. Oh, you know, the bad men and women, they're just going to be wiped out because they can't be competitive. That's not true. Being mean, being nasty, being bad, you can still survive in the market. You could do well. But what's really important is that if you're nice, being nice, that's also a viable alternative. Right. It's just that a lot of people aren't aware of that. You go to business schools, you know, if you go to most business schools, almost no business schools teach about the cooperative model of doing business, or employee ownership, consumer ownership, in terms of banks, member ownership. It's gotten rid of. So people aren't exposed as well as they should, people who get jobs and companies, to the alternative ways of doing things. And right now, the big conversation is about climate change, which is important. But what's missing from the equation, if you wish, is how all of this feeds back or loops back to the position of working people throughout our democracies. And because that's sort of a missing link that a lot of people are saying, well, they don't even contemplate how what they're doing, how they're thinking will impact the vast majority of people in society, and that how that in turn can loop back in a democratic country into the election of tyrants, potentially.
Yeah, no, this is all exactly why I wanted you on the show, because I think these are hugely important issues that get overlooked way too often. And I'm looking at the events in Ukraine, and I'm thinking, you know, there's so many threads to follow here that have huge implications for how we could make our own changes in our own domestic markets. And get to something that's much more fair. You had mentioned in our preliminary conversation that the University of Dundee's business school is, I think you said, the newest business school in the UK.
Yes.
And if that's true, I'm also imagining that part of this is a chance to, as dean, is to fill in some of the gaps, because, you know, I think we both know a lot of the business schools do not particularly go to focusing much on empathy or even mentioning that Adam Smith also wrote the book on moral sentiments. I mean, that part seems to be missing from the executive education as best I can tell in a lot of cases.
Well, in a new business school, we do have some opportunities. So that's what we're trying to do. We'll see how successful we'll be. But basically, what we're trying to do is to make sure students are at least exposed to these alternatives. So it's not about being anti-capitalist, which in some time...
No, I understand.
Right. So you will have some people in business schools or professors say, well, capitalism is evil. You know, have to kill capitalism, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's really about... You have a lot of our students come from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, used to be also from China, from all over the world. They want to go back home and they want to make money. They want to go back home and build a business. What people need to go back home with are the tools and the understandings that they could build a business that's fair and relatively, not equal, but relatively equitable and sustainable in a whole bunch of dimensions. So in Dundee, that's what we're moving in that direction. So it's not that capitalism is evil. It's capitalism can be good. It can be ethical, can be fair. And people going out into the business world need to know how they can create that fairer firm, that fair society, and understand that it's profitable, it's competitive.
Yeah, no, I've given a lot of speeches in Eastern Europe that, you know, obviously was behind the Iron Curtain and heard all sorts of stories and funny jokes making the point that, you know, capitalism reformed is a better vehicle forward than communism and probably most shades of socialism, at least that they had experienced. So I've got no issue with that. I'm curious to what extent you've seen, I mean, almost literally democracy in your studies of companies brought into the workforce. I'm thinking, for instance, even though there's a lot of flaws in this model, including the famous rank and yank method, but when I read about Jack Welch, one of the things that does strike me about his tenure at GE is he has something called the pit at Groton, where he would really spend a lot of face time with people. And I believe there were some opportunities there for kind of anonymous voting on some of the ideas and initiatives that he was putting forward. To what extent have you seen democracy and the voice of employees, rank and file employees, really brought into executive consideration? I've come across a few stories about Nucor, perhaps the steel company in Alabama, trying to bring in worker ideas more. But generally speaking, I'm not finding a lot of examples out there.
I think it's limited, but I think the trick to make it work is not welcoming worker input. There needs to be the reward piece there as well. If there's worker input, well, the workers are contributing to increasing productivity, let's say by 10%. So that should not mean that the CEO is going to have her or his income go up by 40% and the worker's income go up by 0%. So that's the other piece, right? So if we're going to talk about stakeholder capitalism, that should mean that if people are going to be contributing to the company, they should also be rewarded. And if things get messed up in a company, there's a loss of income, the markets fall temporarily, then as it used to be with a lot of Japanese firms, that everyone has to bite the bullet. You know, the CEO, the CFO, the managers, and the workers. Okay, our pay is going to go down by 10% this year. But everyone's pay goes down by 10% or something like that. So anyway, I don't see it's not this type of a change in capitalism. It's not flourishing. And I think part of the reason is that people, activists, are not paying much attention to the needs of workers. Needs of small, medium-sized businesses. People are talking about other things which are important, but a lot of people just don't seem to get how if they don't involve the needs of working people, their favorite project is just going to die. And we saw that almost happened with Trump, and right now Biden is down in the polls. A lot of that has to do with the economy or people's perceptions. So we have to get things right. I think having appropriate and robust, which doesn't mean net mathematical necessarily, economic theory that provides an alternative worldview is critical to changing how we do things in modern capitalist societies.
I absolutely agree. One last thing, you make a lot of point in the book about work cultures, and I think that's important. And I remember when I started my company in San Diego, I used to do my shopping both at Ralph's and at Trader Joe's, which is a more alternative, newer, food store. And it was always striking. I would go in and going in Ralph's and interacting with the employees felt like I was in a morgue. And then I'd go over to Trader Joe's and they were all enjoying each other's company as well as seemingly the customers. It seems to me that as part of going back one last time to Adam Smith and empathy and sympathy, that work culture matters a lot. I know that term can seem fuzzy, but I think deep down it matters a whole lot. I wonder if you, just in your closing remarks here, wanted to say something about work culture.
Yeah, work culture is fundamentally important. It's in a way, it's also about reciprocity. That people have to know there's fairness, but there's a fair exchange between all members of the firm. I have I'm doing a presentation, which is called, it's all about love in the firm. Basically, it's about people sharing and caring and respecting one another. And if you have that in the firm, and it's a way of structuring a firm, it could be owned by a private investor or it could be employee owned. That makes all the difference, because that also, speak crassly, it incentivizes people to be more productive, which pays then for the improved benefits people get in their company, in the company for where they work.
Yeah. So I want to thank you, Morris, so much for being my guest. This has been episode 106 of Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. My guest, Morris Altman, he is the author of Worker Satisfaction and Economic Performance, the episode High Wages, the Engine of Economic Growth and Well-Being. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. You can find other episodes by going to my company's website, the obligatory 3 W's and sensorylogic.com. Or go to the New Books Network and type in the show's name, and you'll see the other 100-plus episodes. Finally, I like to conclude every episode with an epigram that's appropriate. In this case, listening to what you've been talking about, Morris, I think I'm going to go back to William James's comment, which is that people want nothing more in life than to be appreciated. And I guess I'm going to add, I'm hoping that appreciation is also monetary and reciprocal in this case.
Yes, exactly.
So until next time, take care, be well. Thank you so much, Morris.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Okay. Thanks all. Bye-bye.